This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of The Future of Food, a discussion with historians of science D. Graham Burnett and Daniel J. Kevlis on Deborah Coons Garcia's 2004 documentary of the same title. It took place on May 20th, 2010.
It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Professor Daniel Kevlis, who's visiting us from Yale. Only kind of visiting because he's kind of based here in New York, truth be told. But professor at Yale, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about him. We're going to get things rolling by doing a short introduction and contextualization of the film that we're going to be seeing, and then we'll roll the film and have Q&A afterwards. So we'll be sure to save ourselves some time for that at the end. So Professor Kevlis, in addition to being an old friend, is the Woodward Professor of History at Yale University, where he's chaired the program in History of Science and Medicine. And he's the author of a distinguished slate of important books on the history of science in America and beyond, and on the policy questions that relate science and society since the 19th century. They include a book called The Physicist, published in 1979, which was a finalist for the American Book Award, a book called In the Name of Eugenics, published in, I think, 1985, which remains the standard text in the history of the sort of sad, frankly, very sad history of eugenics, serialized in The New Yorker. The Baltimore Case, which is the winner of the Watson-Davis Prize from the History of Science Society, and then most recently, Inventing America, which is a co-authored history textbook, U.S. history textbook, with a strong emphasis on science and technology and its place in the history of this country. He's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a fellow of the American Philosophical Society, and a signal distinction is his having won the Sarton Prize from the History of Science Society, which is the Lifetime Achievement Prize from that organization. That was now 4 or 5 years ago. So that's Dan, as we call him. And then maybe you'd get us going by telling us a little bit about what we're going to see. I mean, I should say maybe one last thing, which is that for the last almost now 8 years, you've been working on questions of intellectual property in living organisms. So it's really in that capacity that we've invited him here to set up this film and to talk with us about it afterwards. So tell us a little bit about what we're going to see.
Okay, Graham, thanks. First, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm a fan of Cabinet ever since Graham introduced me to it, which is about 3 or 4 years ago, I think. It's my first time out in this space, and it's a fascinating place to be. About the film, it's a documentary basically about the genetic engineering of food and its consequences in the world. And the principal subject is the Monsanto Corporation, which is the poster child bad boy in this story. It raises a number of issues. Just to touch on a few of them, it's about what it means to have genetically modified organisms, meaning foods, plants, in this regard. Are the issues in the planning of such organisms, of environmental consequences? What role does corporate power play in the use and the regulation of these organisms? Should there be labeling of them so we know what we are purchasing, just the way, for example, that we have very, very detailed labeling of pharmaceuticals that we also ingest. It's about the exercise of corporate power against farmers who may be planting some of these genetically modified seeds without purchasing a license to do so, and it's how and why that might happen. So it's, as I say, raises a number of issues. I won't say, however, for reasons I'll explain later on, that it really addresses these issues very well in a completely unbiased fashion. And so it's a very, very valuable and provocative film, but it also is a film that needs to be assessed and watched with some critical intelligence.
So because you've been working for some time on the history of this problem of property rights in organisms, which I realize is not coextensive with the problem of genetically modified organisms. It's a much older problem, but it certainly intersects with the problem of genetically modified organisms. Perhaps you could set up a little bit for us the kind of historical context of ownership of this kind of stuff.
Well, first of all, the film goes beyond ownership, as you will see. It's about a lot of different things. Partly, it's about it expresses a nostalgia for a communitarian agriculture that we like to think was characteristic of the United States along with the Western world in, say, the middle of the 19th century. And it hinges the attaches the decline of this kind of communitarian agriculture to genetically modified organisms. I think that's a gross exaggeration, but I'll come back to that in a bit. Basically, the issues arising from genetically modified foods some of which I've listed. It's a current day chapter in a long developing story in the production of food in the Western world. The family farm was characteristic of the production of food, say in 1850, just to choose an arbitrary year, and production of food has changed dramatically since. It's changed dramatically as a result of mechanization, such as the reaper, and then which started out with horsepower-drawn reapers and then turned to gasoline powered reapers. As a result of the introduction of chemical fertilizers as synthesized as distinct from natural fertilizers. And in the 20th century, beginning in the 20th century, for the most part, though, with roots in the 19th century, of the manipulation of organisms by their genetics for improvement. The impact of these external ingredients, so to speak, in the production of agriculture has been enormous. In the middle of the 19th century, the vast majority of Americans were required to produce our food. By 1940, 25% of us were producing all our food. Do you know what the percentage is now?
Less than 10?
Yes, 3%. And this is a result of the enormous productivity that has arisen from mechanization, the application of science, particularly chemical science and genetics, in agricultural productivity. Just to dwell a little bit on genetics for the moment, because that's what genetically modified foods is about. The issues raised by genetically modified foods are partly new, but they're also partly old. The genetic breeding of improved organisms began in the 19th century in the sense of deliberate manipulation of organisms. People have been improving crops for millennia before that, but not by deliberate manipulation because they didn't know anything. They didn't even know that plants have sex, for example, until the end of the 17th century. In the 20th century, with the advent of the science of Mendelian genetics, scientists in a variety of laboratories were able to manipulate genes so as to improve quality, pest resistance against pests, and also yield, abundance, and the biochemical and nutritional qualities of plants. The first major element here, which speaks to some of the issues in the film we're going to see, would be, for example, the creation of hybrid corn. Hybrid corn is a genetically manipulated corn. It was first devised in the teens and the 20s in the 20th century. It was adopted widely in the American farming community around the middle of the 1930s, and it has become, it remains a staple of the American agricultural production of corn. Without it, we would not have anywhere near the productivity that we have in corn today. At the same time, it was a way of getting around the fact that you could not obtain a patent on a living organism at that time. And so what the inventors of hybrid corn did, and then the exploiters, the corporate exploiters, was to do the following. You breed founding parental and grandparental generations, you crossbreed them, and then you sell the seed from the third generation, which is super productive. But if the farmer plants the seed from the fourth generation, that crop degenerates. It's not as good, anywhere near as good, as the seed from the third generation. So by keeping the parental and the grandparental generation secret, you see, as corporate secrets, called trade secrets in the IP world, then this enabled corporations to invest in the creation of highly improved seeded crops at the same time that they would be able to protect their investment through the instrument of trade secrets.
So just so everyone gets that, because you couldn't plant your seed corn, so you couldn't grow a crop, harvest part of that crop, and then plant those seeds.
Well, you could do that, but you wouldn't get, it wouldn't be, like, so that forced the farmer to go back to the company
and buy more seed
every
directly.
Year. So this is the same kind of issue, and nothing to do with genetic engineering as we understand it. But it involves scientific innovation, it involves a way of getting around or manipulating the system to protect your intellectual property, it involves corporations, and it involves large-scale farming.
And that's from the 1930s.
And that's from the 1930s. You can now patent genetically engineered crops. You can obtain what are called utility patents for them. And this, of course, gives rise to some kind of corporate control. At the same time, however, it's not all large corporation or multinational control, because when you have small companies trying to innovate anything, if they can't patent their innovations, then they have a very, very difficult time to getting anybody to invest in them. Sometimes their only asset is an idea and a ticket to the patent office. Okay? So the patenting of living organisms cuts both ways. It cuts in favor of small innovators and new innovators, but it also cuts in favor of very large multinational corporations like Monsanto, who will act to enforce and have acted to enforce their intellectual property rights in ways, as you will see in this film, can be extremely oppressive.
I think with that, we should go ahead and roll. There have already been some hands, but we have lots to talk about after the film goes. The film, am I right, runs about an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes?
Hour and 28 okay. minutes.
Okay. Great. So
okay.
Join me in thanking Dan for getting us going, and let's go.
When you watch it, try to watch it with a little bit of skeptical eye, because ask yourself how many people are interviewed who speak for the biotech industry in general, or Monsanto in particular, or genetic engineers in universities, or farmers who like to use this stuff. I think you will find nobody of those groups. Okay.
Wrong.
Okay, but I mean, we still have a case here, if I'm right, that is established case law, at least in Canada, that says that an individual can be held legally responsible for violations of some licensing provision under conditions that I haven't, of course, read the opinion in this case, but the impression that the film conveyed was that you could be held liable under conditions where it had been established that there was no intent to defraud the patent holder and that there was indeed full ignorance of the existence of this patented genetic material on your property. And if that is in fact now case law in Canada, I'm real surprised. And given what seems like the self-evident difficulties of controlling where these right. crops wind up, I mean, that does seem really weird to me.
Well, first of all, I've read several commentaries on this case in which it's not so clear that Perseus Modular was innocent.
Okay.
He knew that this stuff had blown onto his property and had germinated. But then he harvested the seed from this stuff and planted it. Okay, so you might say, okay, it's on his property, it's his to use as he wishes. But he did knowingly plant the stuff. Now, one can say that, all right, you know, like everything in our society, the law is a matter of a process. So we have new technology, and various corporations seek to exploit and develop it and sell it. And then they make claims which they may believe to be true, that this is going to be good for everybody. But then we can see that under the circumstances, wind, insects, birds, that there is cross-pollination. And so their intellectual property rights ought to be modified. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's not that they should have no intellectual property rights, or it's not necessarily the case there should not be any genetically modified food. It's now on the basis of the experience of the how these things can propagate in agricultural areas and what companies might do to enforce their rights that we have to rethink what intellectual property rights means.
Okay, so let me push you one more time because
regulate
yeah,
them.
Yeah, it's a fresh, nice, cold slap in the face to have you remind us of these kinds of questions. But I'm going to go ahead and move from that legal question of the Canadian case to the, again, I think compelling case that the film makes concerning the fundamental problems with the regulatory apparatus in this country.
This is not unique to biotechnology.
No, certainly not. Although, again, I do think it's not absurd to say that this constitutes a major and important area where you would like to feel confident that there were regulatory...
You see that this fellow, Kimbrell, is extremely slippery. He's an ally of Jeremy Rifkin's. He worked with the Foundation on Economic Trends for a long time. A lot of what he says...
Which guy? The
Kimbrell. He's the most... He was the most...
The bearded guy who's spoken to the camera.
The bearded guy. Okay. A lot of... I would say 50% of what he said is untrue. Starting historically from the U.S. patent system denied patents on living things because they thought it was immoral. That's completely fabrication. All the way up to saying that if you...
The third world stuff.
There's some stuff. Yeah, the third world stuff. That the companies do two things, he said, which were egregiously false. One is the companies can go to the seed banks, take any seed that they wish and patent it. That is just so wrong. I can use stronger language. That it's so wrong. It's criminal for him to say that. Secondly, the companies can go to the third world, and take a tree or a plant, et cetera, and appropriate it and patent it. And then the people in that country can no longer grow that.
He was only saying that was their aim. He didn't say that was the current state of things.
No, he said that's what they can do.
That's not how I heard it. I heard him say that was what they were trying to do, that was what was next, but anyway.
They're not even trying to do that. That's also because even under the strict technical requirements of patent law, you can't do that, all right? You have to create something different in order to get a patent on anything. You just can't appropriate something and patent it. So...
What about the breast cancer gene, though? Hold on, but just one second. There is a patent on a breast cancer gene, which is just a gene that shows up in people.
That seems to me the propensity of the film to draw in everything onto this issue. the patent of a disease for human disease, a gene for human disease, raises much different issues from the patenting of, first of all, the genetic modification, and then the patenting of plants. Right? Now, I want to be clear where I am. I find this film so biased that I'm going to sound like a defender of Monsanto and GMOs. I'm not, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's so biased that somebody's got to say something to try to disentangle what is legitimate about the film from what is illegitimate, and there's a lot that's illegitimate. About organic food, for example, and community local farming. I'm all for that. Who wouldn't be for that? Can we feed the world on the basis of that? Absolutely not. Right. We can't even feed this country on the basis.
Quick aside on that, and something that two pieces that would be of interest to any of you who've hung on to this point in this conversation. Dan himself did a review in the New York Review of Books, an issue or two back.
May 13th.
Which was, a review of Phil Pauly's book, which is about sort of the history. It's a review of a book that deals with the history of nationalism and national identity and America's plants and animals.
Horticulture.
Horticulture, more specifically. So it's a thoughtful review on the deep history of this idea of national identity and plants and culture. And then Michael Pollan has a very smart essay, Anya and I were talking about, I was mentioning it to her beforehand, in the current issue of the New York Review, that really is about the maintenance of something like a political movement with these extraordinarily diverse constituencies, organic foodies, community farmers, people angry at Monsanto in Nebraska who have, you know, 600,000-acre combine farms growing soybeans, who, needless to say, have relatively little in common with the people in Portola Valley who have a thing for some kind of, you know, Taiwanese tomato. It's, you know, so trying to maintain this as a kind of political movement is part of what Pollan is after in that essay. It would be relevant for thinking about some of the different threads in this film. People have questions. I just want to push down one more time because I think you've helpfully disabused us of whatever abuse we might have sustained from the film.
Too many things.
All right. Let me press you on the area of your kind of one of the areas of your tight expertise, because I think you've gone a little fast past what is a not unreasonable elision that the film makes between A, the fact that an actual pharmaceutical company successfully secured a patent under U.S. patent law for a naturally occurring gene in human beings, and did, in fact, use, I think there's plenty of evidence, that patent to cast a cold chill.
Right.
You opposed that patent.
Right.
Good.
But on moral grounds.
Fair enough.
The argument that you can't patent nature, all right, there's something wrong morally about that, gets you nowhere.
Okay, but that's not what I'm saying. Hold on. Let me just say what I am saying, which is that to elide that fact, which everybody got, that is a fact, to... Geez, it worries us a little that a company like Monsanto has got little armies of folks out in the field gathering genetic material from these small plots of genetic diversity around the world. I'm ready to be concerned by that fact because it doesn't seem to me impossible to imagine that part of their plan is indeed to secure intellectual property rights and components of the genetic material that they encounter when they're out there sniffing around. And given what we've just seen about the willingness of their lawyers to push pretty hard to maintain their property interests once they've got a patented chunk of the genome of a plant that's wifting around in the breezes, I am concerned. That seems to me not unreasonable
right.
to be concerned
I think,
about.
I think you're right to be concerned at the same time.
Good. Well, it doesn't seem different to me. These are both genes.
Like the reason for the principal reason for the patent system throughout the world is that it provides an incentive to innovation. Okay? People are not going to invest, whether it's your time or my time or somebody's money or some combination of those two, talent and expertise in something if just for the hell of it, unless you're crazy,
okay,
you know, or romantic or what have you. But most innovation doesn't occur for that reason. So the patent system is an engine of innovation. All right. Now, one of the characteristics of the patent system is that it compels the patent holder upon the granting of the patent, and now even before, to publish what he or she had invented or the corporation. What's the point of that? Well, the point of that is so that other people can find out how it's done and innovate beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the case of a disease, of a gene for a human disease, like the two breast cancer genes, which are at issue here in myriad genetics, they're called BRCA1 and BRCA2. The disease gene is the disease gene to cure completely. There is no way to innovate around it.
I see.
In order to have a test for whether you have BRCA1 or BRCA2, it doesn't help to have a test for BRCA3, 4, or 6, because what you want to know is 1 or 2. So you cannot innovate around it. A disease gene, a human gene, is what an economist would call a natural monopoly. Okay? There are only several ways to deal with a natural monopoly that is important. Natural monopoly in the conventional economic circumstances would be a railroad route, for example, that is unique. It's the only way through the mountains. Or a river, which is the only river that irrigates an entire valley. Right? So we don't allow people to do whatever they please because you can't construct another railroad route or dig another river. We regulate the property right of people who own the railroad or through whose land the river runs. So that's one way you can do it. Or you can socialize the resource. Right? So the way to deal with these disease genes is that there ought not to be patents for two reasons. One is that they are not human inventions. They're not made by man. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what the patent law requires. The companies claim they're made by man because they're extracted from their natural environment of the cell. But the actual fact of the matter is that the DNA sequence that predisposes a woman to breast cancer is exactly the same whether it's in the cell or out of the cell. Mm-hmm. Okay? So no one has invented anything. Mm-hmm. So on that ground, number one, there ought not to be a patent. This is the central argument of the case brought against the myriad patents by the ACLU in the recent months. Second, it defies the purpose, the patents on these genes defy the purpose of the patent law because no one can innovate around it.
Got it.
Okay. That's totally different from the issue of whether you could patent the gene on some kind of corn, because you can have a potato chip corn that you've genetically engineered so somebody else can make a different kind of potato chip.
Okay.
You can invent it. And it also is not a natural. I mean, it also doesn't undermine a larger public interest in health or nutrition because you can eat one kind of potato chip corn or eat another kind of potato chip.
Awesome. I want to make sure that other people, I mean, I could hammer away with Dan for quite some time, but I want to make sure Dave.
So I had a couple of, I guess, interrelated observations that hopefully lead to a question. You know, to what extent is Monsanto the late 20th and early 21st century version of what Cargill was from probably 1880 to, who knows, 1950? You know, this force that had a profound, and if you were
Anya. And I also think, so initially Dan's resistance there was probably that Dan is most of the way finished with a book that he's been working on for some time now that's in some ways about the, you stop me if I don't get this right, but in some ways it's about the kind of professionalization of the world of breeding, of horticulture, and its kind of formalization as a set of commercial activities that really, in the end, take that sort of fantasy story we have about the way individual farmers kind of have preserved genetic diversity and elaborated that genetic diversity and commercialized that activity by making it so it rationalized, directed, focused, et cetera. And that happens very early. Again, that's part of what Dan's book shows in interesting ways of the book manuscript. So, you know, back in the 1790s, you begin to see formal groups taking over that business of kind of concentrated production of new apples, new pears, new everything. And so from that point forward, I think it's fair to say that across at least much of Western Europe and the United States, farmers are indeed growing stuff, but they're growing stuff that's mostly been made by somebody whose business it is to make new apples and that kind of stuff. So his sort of no farmers don't do that, it may proceed from it's, having historicized it.
The point of view of breeding, right, as distinct from just selection, which is what people have been doing. Our own Native Americans, for example, all the corn that we got, you know, that the Puritans got, the Jamestown people got from the Indians, was selected and developed from that teosinte plant, which you see is doesn't look like corn that we know. They did it by selection. But for breeding is an expensive business because you don't know whether the crosses you make will be useful. It takes land in order to grow the crosses, to do the breeding. It takes time. And that's land that could otherwise be devoted to the production of crops for the market. So the farmer is much more interested production of crops in the market and will take seed or new animals or whatever
I'd like to just hit again, for me, like the power of the regulatory story here. I mean, I just think that what Dan just said, which is, you know, corporations are not moral agents, and yet they're extremely important to civilized life as we've come to know it and to like it, bears repeating. And on top of that, it's worth saying that since they aren't moral agents, the only way to constrain their rational self-maximizing tendencies is to be committed and serious about a regulatory state. And you know, we've let a lot of that go in the last 15 years, and we're responsible for that.
Well, longer 15 years since the revolution. Anyway, one of the problems, it seems to me, with the regulation of genetically modified foods is that the regulatory powers are distributed among too many agencies. So the film made the point that the USDA did nothing about the environmental issues raised, you know, posed by the planting of genetically modified crops. Well, they're not authorized to do that. The EPA is the one that's supposed to do that. Food safety is in the bailiwick of the Food and Drug Administration, as the Monsanto executive said. I think that was callous and irresponsible. But that's nevertheless the truth. And then there's one more agency, I forget which it is, but there are four different agencies. And it might be a good idea or useful to start thinking about maybe a single agency that combines all of the regulatory authority over genetically modified foods, starting from planting and growth over to process, harvesting, processing, and selling.
A last question or two, and there have been several efforts to produce these kinds of universal property rights. They date back.
Well, this is not biodiversity. That's the main burden of this convention, but property rights are part of it.
And I'm just saying that several international conventions that have included such provisions have sunk in the U.S., including.
There's one that's really important that we adhere to, which is the under the World Trade Organization, the Trade Related Intellectual Property, the TRIPS Agreement from 1994. Kimbrough was alluded to that. And he, again, he distorted it. It's a worldwide convention. Most of the nations of the world are at least signatories to it. We are, Western Europe, and most of the third world is. It does not say that that every nation in the world must conform to the same intellectual property regime that prevails, say, in this country or in Western Europe. But it does say that every nation in the world must create its own version of an intellectual property regime, which in many cases is, they have been created and they intend to protect intellectual property rights of indigenous genetic resources. So they too are buying into the IP regime, you see, for plants, but in a way that protects them and allows them to profit from their natural resources. It's just the way they sell, you know, minerals or you know, or fruit or what have you. They're trying to capitalize on their intellectual property.
Just connected to that, is there an effort to try to measure, let's say, the biodiversity in a particular region and then protect it to the extent that if genetically modified crops or organisms of some kind invade that area that's protected and reduce the degree of biodiversity?
That individual nation. But you raise a very good point.
Or something.
Yeah, you raise a very good point. You know, the film, again, implied without examining its own logic that to promote genetically improved organisms, in this case by genetic engineering, necessarily leads to monocrops, that is, the reduction in biological diversity. It doesn't in and of itself. It's only if the agricultural sector permits it to, right? And the reduction in biodiversity long predates, I mean, in agriculture, long predates genetic engineering.
And the biggest threats to the forms of biodiversity that you're describing are certainly not, at least now, and not for a good long time, like this is obvious, genetically modified organisms. The real threats to those kinds of biodiversity have been, for well over 500 years, simply human transportation of invasive species of a perfectly natural sort, weedy species, which has, you know, been a documented phenomenon dating well back to the but it is interesting to think about how you would sort of set a baseline condition from which you could then monetize damage caused by invasive organisms. That's kind of a crazy idea. But
well, as we're getting down to having such a low degree of biodiversity.
Well, you're right about
our
that, but you can take maybe a little bit of comfort in the following. All over the world, there are major repositories of seeds and plants in order to maintain world's heritage of biodiversity. And it's precisely so that if something is, some one crop is jeopardized by reason of an infestation that you can't control, that if it's wiped out, it can be replaced by something else. There are, in this country, there are two or three major seed banks, plus there are installations for the maintenance of the diversity in fruits, such as apples, pears. Geneva, New York is a major repository for lots of varieties of apple trees. Oregon has pear trees and strawberries. And the reason that you need to maintain these not as seeds but as living plants is that what is unique and luscious about them is in their existing genetic makeup. And if you allow them to reproduce, or you try to reproduce them by normal sexual congress between plants, you would get a different genetic makeup, and the strawberry you like wouldn't be reproduced. So what they do is maintain these plants, things like strawberry, vines, plants, grapes, and apple, pear trees, plum trees, and so on, in their existing form, and when they begin to die, they clone them so that they will continue.
That's
the answer to one answer to biodiversity.
We probably should wrap. I have a last thought, just given that I take from this film the real importance of rigor in maintaining the mechanisms of the regulatory state. I do, a flag is raised for me by the happy story with which the film ends, namely organic food, which I suspect many of us enjoy. And that goes like this. You know, if the question is the politics of regulation, which is a kind of national issue and an actual ballot box type political issue, what worries me is in fact that the growth of the kind of local farming, local productivity, organic food type, relatively high ends, that whole movement risks, in a weird sort of way, sapping a significant chunk of people who could otherwise be politically mobilized on these regulation questions by giving them a kind of safe space in which to operate. That is, basically we're in good because there is this kind of parallel food production universe, and I certainly feel like
it's an interesting point.
That in effect may drain off some of the kind of political pressure that we really need to maintain.
Yeah, and I think the political pressure is really important because, as I've said several times already this evening, I I just don't see if we can feed our own country, let alone the rest of the world, on local community farming.
And it doesn't have to do that. It could also be a mechanism. It could also be a mechanism for politicizing those same communities, and that would be ideal. But that seems to me something that needs to be worked out in those communities to maintain the, you know, the force of political activity in these collective directions toward regulation. Please, we should probably break up and have further conversation, have kind of a while on. But join me in thanking Dan.